Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we turn the page and return to our review of Yahweh's profound prediction regarding Damascus, regarding Syria, regarding what's going to happen in Israel and his overt warning against the United States, we have Glenn, and I'd like to hear what you have to say. Hello, Glenn.
I've been following the news closely today, Yana. The Russians may well be regretting and reconsidering their actions in view of the brutal, backlash of sanctions imposed on them by the Obama administration. I mean, first he pummeled them by canceling the presidential delegation to the Sochi Paralympics. And furthermore, they've recently imposed visa restrictions on a handful of Russian officials. And now they're threatening to simply not talk to them. They've really got to be quaking in their boots.
You know, why would we even try, first of all, of course, what you're saying is, and you're being facetious here, why would we even try to be adverse to the Russians under this circumstance? They've done nothing wrong. If there's anyone to blame here, it's what happened in Kiev. They've done a lot wrong. Their government is bankrupt. They're wholly dependent on handouts. They had a coup led by a gang in Kiev, and now they're asking for billions of dollars just to survive. What happened that was wrong in Crimea? Because I don't get it.
Well, it's just blatant hypocrisy. It's like the husband who cheats on his wife, accusing the wife of cheating. In blatant hypocrisy. It is just amazing. They're banking on people not understanding what has transpired, I will say, I think some, the forces on the ground in Crimea, like I say, a lot of those tanks and trucks and uniforms were unmarked. So, the Russians could be playing plausible deniability games in terms of the numbers and who's who in Crimea as well. But frankly, I wondered what took them so long. Just run up and cut it off at the isthmus right away.
But Glenn, the reality is that Crimea, as an autonomous region, has its own defense forces. They responded not after Putin got authorization, but the same day that there was the problems in Kiev, they responded the same day, and they took over their parliament the same day. So, and it's the exact same uniforms that were there. If you look at all of the video feeds and all of the pictures, the exact same equipment, the exact same uniforms, the same exact individuals that responded a week before Putin is accused of invading were already there. And so
there was a naval headquarters building there in Crimea, like not too far from the port at Sevastopol. But and supposedly 700 Ukrainian military personnel defected and swore allegiance to Crimea, which is apparently that was after a certain ultimata were issued that they would be fired upon.
But that doesn't mean that Putin directed the Russian military to do that. You have extraordinarily strong feelings in Crimea against the Ukrainian government in Kiev, and this was their opportunity to say, we don't want to be part of that anymore. I don't blame them for not wanting to be part of it anymore. And so, you've got Crimeans now expressing their desire, just as you had those in Kiev express their desire. Both are doing it, not through a popular vote, but both are doing it through kind of gang mentality, protests, and then parliamentary votes. So it's, but the hypocrisy thing you brought up resonates with me. Here's the United States telling Russia that it can't invade the Ukraine. Now, didn't fire a shot. Didn't bludgeon anyone. And here's the United States. We've invaded Korea.
Yeah.
We invaded Vietnam. We invaded Laos and Cambodia. We invaded Pakistan and Grenada. We invaded Afghanistan not once but twice. We invaded Iraq not once but twice. We put our troops into Somalia. Who are we to say that the Russians can't use their military, but we can?
Well, we have our troops. You know, in the quest for Pax Americana, we have our troops in over 120 countries worldwide, and some of them are guarding opium poppy, previously forbidden opium poppy fields in Afghanistan, for God's sake.
Of course.
You know,
you know, today in Afghanistan, we aren't supposed to use our Air Force to bomb. And after part of the agreement during this turnover period, we would stop using our Air Force to bomb in Afghanistan, because every time we did, we ended up killing Afghani civilians. Today's bombing run did not kill Afghani civilians. We killed Afghani troops.
Right.
How in the world are you going to endear yourself to a people when you arm and put nice uniforms on their troops, provide them with all sorts of fancy equipment, and then bomb them?
Right. We don't know how that happened. We're looking into it. Like, that's the answer you get. That's a shame. We're looking into it.
We've heard those reports. Yeah, we'll look into it. The last one was the last time we bombed in Afghanistan, we killed a dozen members of one family, women and children. You know, we're out of control. We have killed in Yemen and in Pakistan using our drones. We've killed 4,000 people in the last 4 years. Now, you tell me how we can use our drones to kill those who have never threatened America, who aren't at war with America. But we can use our drones, and our president can decide you live and you die, and that's appropriate. But the Russians can't have anything to say in Crimea that was part of Russia for hundreds of years?
I forget where exactly they were deployed to. I just heard on the news that they deployed six F-16s somewhere this morning. I'm like,
oh, yeah. No, the Balkans.
F-16.
Yeah, in the Balkans. In the Balkans, we've decided we're going to play war games in the Balkans so that we can rattle the Russians. I mean, I'm going to tell you,
they're quaking at 6 F-16s.
Well, I can tell you emphatically that if the United States and Russia were to engage in war, if Obama, and he's stupid enough to do it, he almost did it with Syria, sending cruise missiles and bombers over the Russian fleet into to bomb Damascus, which would have started World War III.
Right.
And this president is arrogant enough to do that, unprofessional enough to do that. But if right now Russia and the United States were to go to war with one another, both would lose. The U.S. military, using conventional forces, even having to project those forces across the world, would be able to defeat the Russian military. But in the process of prosecuting that conflict, what little is left of America's economic independence would just be utterly and completely destroyed.
Look,
we would be in anarchy within 6 months of the time of propagating that kind of war, and America, as you know it, would cease to exist.
Well, the stock market could die precipitously without taking everything down, but if the bond market bubble blows, everything comes down with it.
Correct.
You know,
we can't afford to fight another war. We couldn't afford to fight the last two wars that we fought. We can't afford our military. If we were to use our military in Russia, they would beat the Russian military. But the consequence would be the utter destruction of the United States. Why would we be rattling our sabers when there's only a lose-lose game here, and particularly over the Ukraine, which is a complete liability for everyone?
I just thought of the perfect metaphor.
Yes, go ahead.
Cleave on Little in Blazing Saddles, putting his gun to his own throat.
Yeah, there you go.
And Minutia sketches.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, you know, it's one of my favorite lines, and I'll butcher it, but it's one guy's confessing to his life of crime, and he says, you know, what I do for a living is I rape, I steal, I burn, and I rob, and I rape. And this guy says, you've already mentioned rape, and he says, but I really like rape.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be laughing, but it's kind of what we're doing that in the world is that, and it is when we now transition to this prophecy about the fall of Damascus. It's America's malfeasance. It's our interference in the world. It's our stupid use of our military that has brought this war into Syria and is going to cause the fall of Damascus. And we might say, who cares if Damascus falls? Well, we ought to care, because what happened once we deployed our military prowess in a proxy war against Afghanistan, in Afghanistan against the Russians? What did those jihadists do when that war was over?
Right.
Perpetrated 9/11. They perpetrated the bombings in Africa, the bombings throughout Europe. They brought the war home to the countries that they had left to become, to fight the great jihad. And exactly the same thing is going to happen in this Syrian conflict.
Man, it could be bad, yeah. And, yeah, yesterday you were talking about the Damascus thing, and yesterday, 17 and all. The, I guess it remains to be seen who might perpetrate that, but it could be the U.S., the Saudis, Israel. Less likely, I think, Iran doing it to, you know, get foreign troops who've moved in. But anyway, regardless.
You're talking about the utter destruction of Damascus. And, you know, the prophecy, the way it's written, seems to indicate that Damascus is going to fall at the hands of the Mujahideen, because it speaks of roaming bands of terrorists, and them finally having no more civilians left to terrorize. And it seems like what's going to happen, based on the way the prophecy reads, that the highly likely outcome is that the Sunni Mujahideen are ultimately, after what will be maybe 10 to 15 years of conflict, we're about to year 4, so I think it's going to be 15 years of conflict, they're finally going to destroy everything, and that's the principal destructive force in Damascus, and that brings the Assad regime down, is the Sunni Mujahideen. Now, that is not to say, though, that it isn't exacerbated by other nations. And it could well be that the United States does start bombing there, and it's very possible that the Iranians will say, you may have knocked our guy out, but what you will get as a result is nothing but scorched earth, and they could use a nuke finally in Damascus after they have lost. So those could be adjunct to the long terrorist war. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The prophecy regarding the fall of Damascus begins as follows. It says, a prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt, and will be removed from inhabited cities. And she shall totally and actually become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Now, we are witnessing this occur as we speak, but I do think that if all of this happens as it's laid out, that we would expect the Syrian proxy war to be fought for perhaps as much as another decade. So it could be 14 or 15 years. And this this ultimate declaration of a twisted and tangled heap of rubble is what we're witnessing now, with them shelling one another. It is what we could expect to be the result of just a continuation of this. But it also could be a result of the United States, because the United States is specifically warned in the beginning of the next chapter. And we should never come to the conclusion that these events are being presented only sequentially. Because very often God presents events in parallel. In fact, in the most famous line from Yahshua, Isaiah, in the 9th chapter, when it's speaking of Yahusha, this child who is born, this son who is given to us, it presents every aspect of his nature, not in parallel, but not in sequential order, but in parallel. as to who we represent. So it's, this could be the same thing. So it could be the United States doing what Obama had wanted to do here a year ago, to bomb Damascus. And we could reduce it to a heap of rubble. And it could also be the Iranians, who I think already have, but if they don't already have, will soon have a nuclear bomb. They could say after the Sunnis prevail, well, this is what you get. Here's your grand prize. What do you think of us now? But the bottom line is, the 2,750 years ago, back at a time there wasn't even a Syrian government, but there was a Damascus. The longest continually inhabited city in the world was predicted to fall. And it was predicted to fall in concert with events happening during the last days. So God either is a really good guesser, or something extraordinary is going on here. Now, the next word, and we still have Glenn, and feel free, Glenn, to comment on this at any time. The next, there's a word used in this next statement that probably deserves a little analysis before we just read the next statement. It's auroror, and it could speak of a number of different things. Auroror depicts Muslims and the sense of the Palestinians, because it speaks specifically of those who are outcasts and thus refugees. And of course, the mythical people known as the Palestinians are outcasts in the countries that they have refugee status currently. And God's not very pleased with them, because they should be noticed, because they have so terrorized Israel for so many years and want its obliteration. Auroror also speaks of a cypress tree, and the cypress tree is specifically associated with Lebanon. So it could well be the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. But also it speaks of Jordan, in the sense that Auroror was a town in Amman, and Amman is Jordan today. So you've got the largest concentrations of Palestinian refugees who are outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon. And so it's highly likely that's who Yahweh is referring to by the auroror, who will be a casualty of the Syrian war. Now, it's a little more interesting, too, because auroror is related to arutz, which means dreadful and horrible wadi. Now, there is a dreadful and horrible wadi. From God's perspective, the most dreadful and horrible wadi in the world, and that's Mecca. And Mecca is where Islam began, and Islam is the greatest blight on Israel that man has ever created. So the birthplace of Islam is a horrible wadi. But also, that when we consider auroror, what we find is that it speaks of, it's from Aritz, and it speaks of ruthless terrorism, which is Islam's signature act. And the theological world book of the Old Testament actually affirms that the root of auroror is arud, which is used in Job 39:5, to depict a wild ass. Now, that's interesting as it relates to Islam, in that Yahweh said that Ishmael's descendants would be wild asses of men. And Islam professes today to be a descendant of Ishmael. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are analyzing the second statement that Yahweh is making relative to the fall of Damascus. He says, abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited regions of auroror. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias who are dispossessed, but then there will be no one left to terrorize. So abandoned and forsaken, it's azab. Azab is about the nastiest word there is in Hebrew. It means to be rejected, to be deserted, to be estranged, to be left behind, to be separated, to be destroyed, to be damned. That's the connotations of azab. You don't want to be azab. The azab now is directed at Ir, which are either inhabited regions or populated cities, would be the primary connotations of Ir, of Aurora of the Outcasts, which I'm fairly confident is a reference to the Palestinian refugees. Now, we know that they're not Palestinians, but nonetheless, there's a group of people that parade under this title, who consider themselves outcasts of the promised land, who consider themselves to be refugees, who have spent a considerable amount of time terrorizing Israel. And God is always willing to expose to azab those who torment his land and his people. And the Arnon Valley in Ammon is a reference to Jordan. The cypress tree, which is another direct translation of Aurora, is a reference to Lebanon. And the repudiated and destitute who lay bare, though stripped of all pretense, of the impoverished and vulnerable, which is a definition of Aurora, along with wild ass, all seem to fit Islam through Ishmael. So what we're going to see is the refugees, the outcasts, are going to become a casualty of the fall of Damascus. They are despised, by the way. You know, it's something we see regularly, that since they don't seem to fight effectively with other Muslim jihadists hate them. And you see them ravaged on a regular basis. And they are. That's their fate. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias who are dispossessed, that are adar, abandoned as a group, because they have collectively missed the way, having failed miserably. Now, if it's diacritically marked Edar rather than Adar, the same exact word in the way it's written in Hebrew, but the Masoretes chose various vocalizations. There is a vocalization of the exact same three letters that could be that there will be roaming flocks of goats and herds of donkeys. So if you think that the nature of this abandonment and forsaken nature of the regions of Aurora and the twisted heap of rubble that is now Damascus is that God's going to tell us that there's going to be flocks of goats and herds of donkeys, that's an option. I don't think it's a very credible option when the same letters mean roaming animals fighting in militant militias. So I'm going to go with that one. But it is a choice, and be aware of that. Then God says, on Chirad. It's actually wa on Chirad, which means, but to them, there will be no one left to terrorize. I guess that it's possible that you could get a goat with an upset stomach and a donkey in a bad mood, and they would maybe act in a mean way. But I think it's better that we view fighting in militant militias to the point that there'll be no one left to terrorize. They will have ravaged the civilian population. Go ahead.
Sort of a zombie land scenario.
Exactly.
You know, I've been looking at watching all the heightened tensions in recent years, and looking at the time frame, and it just seems like I've been wondering what might slow things down, because it seemed like things were moving
right
too quickly, and the tensions were too heightened. And it seems to me that now there seems to be like a certain sense of the pressure being taken off the pressure cooker. Now that this Ukraine thing has happened, and, you know, Ukraine is now effectively balkanized, divided, and it just seems to me it's shifted the geopolitical emphasis, changed the landscape enough that this may actually be something that changes, you know, slows things down a bit to fit the time frame a little better.
Yeah, I'd expand that. First of all, we are in agreement that as I looked at what was happening in the Islamic world, particularly after Obama's speech where he ignited the passions of fundamentalist Muslims and began what became the Islamic Reformation and started the takeover of Tunisia and Egypt and Syria and Turkey as well by fundamentalist Muslims. that as that occurred, I was saying, how in the world are we going to survive another 10 or 15 years until the timing of the tribulation is scheduled to begin? And so there were a number of throttling mechanisms, and one of them happens to be the Sunni jihadists turning on one another, and these savages savaging and ravaging one another. So that was part of it. Now, I'm going to just expand your Ukrainian thing. The United States isn't just denouncing and threatening the Ukraine and Russia over the Ukraine right now. We're also denouncing and threatening China. Remember, we told China they couldn't have their air defense zones, that the Chinese, according to Obama, we have to change our defensive spending so we have fewer in the army, and we spend more money not just on ships, but on we cut the money we're going to spend on coastal ships that protect America's coast, and we spend more money on ships that can project our force toward China. So we're tongue-lashing the Chinese, vilifying them as the new enemy. But in addition to the Russians and the Chinese, at the same time, Obama's tongue-lashing the Israelis and saying, you Israelis have to capitulate and give up most of your land, or we're going to make you an international pariah. The United States is just all over the board, making enemies everywhere. And so I think collectively we can see that the distractions will allow this war in Syria to go on. And here you have the UN saying, you know, it's all the fault is the great powers because they haven't responded properly and convinced these people to all play by the rules of war. You know, there is no solution in Syria. So I do think that it is going to go on. Here you look at Egypt, too, another throttling mechanism whereby the Muslim Brotherhood won 2/3 of the votes, but they were deposed by a military coup. There are no good sides here. Now, who do you, as America, side with? The Muslim Brotherhood, which is now outlawed there, who won the elections, the popular vote, or the military junta that took power in a coup?
Right. It's all very messy. I'm beginning to hear these supposed intelligence leak rumblings about some sort of financial event in the spring here in April in the U.S., possibly, you know, something like that, a major stock market downturn or bond market blowout or a bank holiday or something like that. Basically coming from various quarters.
Yeah, our biggest issue in terms of the American economy right at the moment is that we postponed the inevitable with quantitative easing. Our bonds were no longer saleable at anywhere near the interest rates we were willing to give them. And if we increase the interest rates on our bonds, then our national debt would skyrocket because at the proper interest rates, which is probably 10 to 12% for our bonds, for the risk that's being taken by the investor, then we would add 1.7 trillion dollars to already a $1 trillion deficit, and our deficit would grow by 2.7, nearly $3 trillion a year. It'd just be a death spiral. And so we have postponed the inevitable through quantitative easing, where we created the illusion of money and used that illusion of money to buy our own bonds. That's not a card game that's going to stand for any length of time. So, you know, what is going to happen? The world is very quickly trying to eliminate the United States as a reserve currency and to come up with alternatives to the U.S. dollar being a reserve currency. What happens then? What happens when Europe and the United States don't get along on a major issue and the European economy is now bigger than the United States economy? You know, what happens when Europe, which is now the leading economy in the world, the European Union, says the euro should be the de facto clearing currency for the world? What happens then to dollars?
Right. The final abrogation of Bretton Woods, you know.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very serious problem that we're in. And since 100% of the U.S. economy now, in terms of its valuation of dollars, is based on faith. And it's faith in that which has no merit whatsoever, because our currency is based on debt. The moment that a significant amount of Americans start to question it, it falls apart. This is a belief system, just like a religion is a belief system. And the moment people start not to believe it anymore, to question it, it falls apart like a house of cards. So we could have a catastrophic event, a meltdown of the United States at any time, and it could happen without so much of a day's warning. Now, I am convinced, by the way, and this prophecy is going to end up in the United States, so we're not talking out of school here. But I'm convinced that the way that the United States is going to deal with this is the same way that the European Union dealt with Cyprus, which is that they're going to confiscate savings. And for two-thirds of Americans, maybe even three-quarters of Americans, confiscating savings means nothing because they have $250 to $1,000 in savings, if that. So confiscating savings means nothing to them. But at the same time they'll confiscate savings, they're going to forgive all debt. And since most Americans are in debt, about $250,000 to $300,000 between their credit card balances, their auto loans, and their home mortgages, forgiving debt will be extraordinarily enticing. And so the offer will be, if you accept the new monetary system, which will be an electronic currency, we will all your debts are forgiven, and we'll confiscate savings, so we start whole again with this new approach. Bingo, as you say, everyone rolls over and capitulates because so many people are dependent on government already, and that is the likely scenario, and that could be imposed really at the blink of an eye. You could go from Friday to Monday and be there. Based upon what we have learned thus far, the demise of Damascus is going to also ripple into Lebanon and Jordan. The refugees living there, these Muslims, are going to suffer a self-inflicted wound. Marauding bands of Mujahideen will act like savage animals. And it's exactly what their religion has bred them to become. And they will kill until there's no one left to terrorize, at least there. And then they will finally pour out of Syria, out of Lebanon, out of Jordan. And they will go back home and they will terrorize in America, in Europe, in Africa, throughout the world. It is what they have been trained to do. It's what they celebrate. That is largely because there is no distinction between civilians and militants in Islam. So the war that is being fought in Syria between the Sunni and Shiites is almost exclusively now a war between civilians, between militants, between Mujahideen, between jihadists. Yes, I recognize that there is still a Syrian army, but the most effective force, even for the Assad regime, is Hezbollah, which is a civilian group of Mujahideen. And so when you get in the mode of killing civilians, it's really tough to get out of that mode. And so they're going to come back, and unlike Americans who have come back from Afghanistan and Iraq and are taking their lives at the rate of almost 80 per day, they're not going to take their lives without taking out others with them, because that's the golden ticket in Islam to Allah's brothel. And so that's what we're going to witness. The fact is, according to the Quran, all good Muslims are terrorists and all peaceful Muslims are hypocrites. This is the throttling mechanism that we are witnessing right now in Syria. This is precisely what we're witnessing in Iraq as well, in addition to Lebanon and to Jordan. There are no good sides in any of these conflicts, only various grades of depravity. Muslims have been conditioned to kill, and they don't seem to care if they're murdering Jews, Christians, Hindus, communists, or fellow Muslims. So long as one group's leader is different than another's, Sunni will kill Sunni, and most certainly Sunni will kill Shia. Even in the Quran, we find the same universality. Muhammad and his wannabe God began terrorizing their neighbors, fellow Arabs, in Mecca. Then they turned their attention to killing monotheistic Jews. When they had overhunted Jews, they created a new enemy. It was the Byzantine Christians. And finally, when not enough Muslims of Muhammad's initial clan wanted to go off and attack the Byzantines, he turned their attention on fellow Muslims and said, good jihadists need to kill those peaceful Muslim hypocrites. This, the prophecy continues with these words. And there is a part of this that could be interpreted in two very different ways. So let me read the whole thing to you, and then we'll talk about what part of this is two options, really. So the fortified place will cease to exist because of Ephraim, along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria, for being similarly vehement and burdensome. The children of Israel shall continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. Now, because this begins, so the fortified place will cease to exist, he's reinforcing the fact that Damascus is going to fall, and the reinforcing that the outcasts, the refugees in Lebanon and Jordan will succumb. Now, this is the place where it becomes a question. It reads that, so the fortified place will cease to exist, and then it's men. Men most often reads from, can mean out of in Hebrew, but it can also be translated because of or on account of. So if Damascus fails, but Israel survives, then the fortified places of these Muslim terrorists that wish to besiege Israel, the so-called Palestinians, them ceasing to exist could be on account of Ephraim, which represents the northern kingdom. It could be because of Ephraim. But it also could mean that Ephraim is going to be ravaged as well. I think here, though, that men is best translated because of.